because you're being detected, you're being collected on, you're being assessed.
To Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Adam Camilleri.
Oh, hey there.
What's up, gentlemen?
What up?
I am good, man. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I had an interesting call from a buddy. He says, Paul, I have an emergency, 40K emergency. I said, oh, what can I do? And I wasn't sure what to expect. you never know, get these calls. And he's like, how on earth do I give a vehicle a cover save? And I said, you can't.
Yep.
Basically, the best we can offer is a neg one to hit.
Correct. It's rough considering what it was, because it was actually relatively very easy to give them a cover save in 7th edition and relatively straightforward to do it in 8th edition. But now it's just not a thing.
Yeah. Well, so with the keywords, they're very specific about what they affect, what they don't affect, and then what you can do. So even in a city fight situation, the best you can get from a vehicle is, I think it's the dense cover keyword that gives them a minus one to hit.
Correct. As far as I can tell, that's exactly correct.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah. Who's to say there won't be different things? I mean, of course, there are auras, I think, that affect. I mean, there's things you can do if you want to play a vehicle centric thing and with different armies. But yeah, and it got me thinking, in a lot of competitive environments that I've been in, or I'm talking about tournaments or series of games or whatever, terrain is almost like a pass fail. Is it blocking line of sight or is it not? Mm. And that's really what you're most concerned about. So obviously, if you can't shoot at it, can't see something to shoot at it, then you are getting the benefit of cover. And that seems to be the guiding force as opposed to actual cover save.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we did our little snapshot of how we're feeling about 9th edition last week. And pretty much unanimously, the three of us that were on that show, we all said that we like how terrain works in 9th edition. Completely glossed over the fact that, it doesn't work for vehicles or monsters. Do you think that's a failing or an oversight, or do you think that's just as intended?
I mean, it seems to be intended. I mean, because it's so specific, there were multiple ways to potentially address that, and none of those opportunities were taken. So I kind of have to assume that's the intent.
I feel like there should be a way for them to get it, but I would like it to be considerably harder than, for everybody else.
Well, it just seems like there's not a mechanism. The rules could support adding that if necessary.
It would literally just be a slight keyword change, I believe.
Or a change look to at their,
obscuring.
They've got this kind of scaling mechanic aspect to it, right? So there's three unit types that get the benefit of all these different covers. And then you step out of that and you have everything else doesn't benefit. And then they have the even worse benefit, or the worst category, which is if you go above 18 wounds, and then you essentially can be seen at all times, but you can't necessarily see things on the opposite side. So there's something to a size factor to this mechanic. And I understand what you're saying, but you got to think about we used to have, you used to have to determine 50%, right?
Yeah, you 25%, are you this, that, and the other?
Yeah, it's 25% to get any kind of cover. And then, if you were 75 or greater, you got plus one to whatever that cover save was.
Sure, something to that effect. And so there were things like that. There, as you move forward and you're trying to speed things up in the same vein of which they got rid of blast templates and things like that, we're looking at, okay, so if you do, let's say you just change the keywords. Okay, so suddenly you have a monolith, it just puts a quote unquote toe in to the terrain, and suddenly that entire monolith has a cover save. And
I do not want that back.
That's right. Nobody does.
I remember I lost a game of 40K. Not that I don't lose heaps, but I lost this game because this guy had a Wraith Knight that had literally a millimeter of its base in a forest.
And standing in a bush.
Cover save.
Like a
it was on the side
over
of the forest.
It was
on the side of the forest facing my army. So it had already walked over the forest, and the barest millimeter on the other side of the forest was in the forest. It got a 5 up against my 3 you know, my Pask in a Punisher, couldn't kill the guy, ended up just ruffle stomping his way through my lines. That felt pretty awful. So I can definitely agree with Red that we don't want that to be a thing. I'd actually, if I had to make a guess, I'd like it to be kind of the example I gave before, but you get plus one if you're 75% or more obscure. But then I suppose that got, we got rid of that because it was it was obscure. It wasn't clearly defined. What is 75% of a land race chassis?
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously
75% of a chassis.
74%.
Exactly. Cover. Like, okay. There's no way, right?
Exactly.
So the G-Dub has removed all those abstracts.
To a certain extent, right?
Yeah.
Well, talking about intent, I mean, even with smoke launchers and the foul smoke screen and that kind of thing, it still only gives you the minus one.
Yep.
It doesn't give you a cover or a plus to your save.
Well, I don't want to do much foreboding or, you know, jump the gun too much on some of the things that Warhammer Community's released lately, e.g. the profiles for some of the AdMech weapons that got released. Was it this morning or last night? For me, at least. And, man, I have some fears for vehicles in this meta moving forward. Just, well, if all LAS... So the Cognos LAS cannons, you know, I'm a bit dishing the lead here, but the Cognos LAS cannons for AdMech, and I'm assuming this is going to be for more LAS cannons in the future, have gone to D3 plus 3 damage, mm-hmm. which I think is something that in all of 8th edition we wanted. So I'm not unhappy about
that. More consistent
damage.
I mean, there's you know, we talk about, you know, we kind of wail a bit about how the guard are struggling a bit. And a lot of it is because it's, I get D6 shots, which turns into half as many hits, which then turns into I rolled a 1 for my damage or whatever. It's it's cumulative. You know, the field bass can be cumulative. And so we want the big guns to be deadly. We want to feel like they pack a punch. And D3 plus 3 on those weapons sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, me too. But like I said, it does give me some fears for what we could very well see these things doing in the future. Like 2 Darklance shots, just like ices a Rhino now. Just absolutely ices it. It was there, now it's gone. That feels, it feels like they might in the future need more, another mitigating factor. Something that a player can do to not let it just get instant shot and instant killed.
Well, I mean, Impulsors do have an invulnerable save, so.
It's true. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, maybe that could be a thing. Just more vulnerable saves on vehicles.
No, I mean, I know you're just using a Rhino as the like typical example of a transport, theoretically hardy transport on the table.
Yeah, exactly right.
So yeah, it's, but again, you know, 5 inches obscuring, I guess. I mean, I think that, you know, you do need line of sight blocking terrain, but that, you're right, that's not the only answer. And maybe vehicles need another keyword or some keyword that applies to them.
Yeah, well, I feel like monster should get a keyword, and like tank could be a keyword. I'm sure Red would approve of tank being a keyword. Like his eyes just bugged out as soon as I said it. He's like, what? Yeah, all right. I mean, what this man's putting down.
It would be an add-on. Remember, I mean, it did. It used to be a thing, right? And not necessarily keyword, but things used to have like the tank rule or the tank,
you know, skimmer. It used to be something,
right. It was something that was added on back, you know, in the dark times of universal rule sets. And so I totally understand more differentiation and what that goes into. I mean, even looking at, you know, the Dark Eldar, they have the shock prows, right? You just add shock prow in and then it adds the effect through a stratagem or whatever. Like, what's preventing, I'm just saying, we've got all this terrain and all these different things. And, you know, in modern times, we are 38,000 years removed from this future state in which we're playing. A tank could just drive and not stop, just keep going through all sorts of stuff. Like these buildings we have, like I love the terrain. But when I sit there and look at some of these walls, and you're going to tell me that a tracked vehicle, that a Bane Blade can't just roll through that terrain.
Like,
I mean, when I see a Bane Blade,
I do this all the time.
It literally would create its own highway. Like, there's nothing stopping it. That you can't tell me that the infrastructure of these buildings are going to beat out that tank. This thing's going to crush them.
It's plasticrete, man. It's plasticrete.
Yeah.
It's a different thing.
And so there's a lot of other stuff, but that, you know, we're talking outside of the abstractions.
We are very much dealing in something that has to be codified into a rule set where we play. The fact that he was so concerned because it was a different way than he was used to playing. Again, none of us have as many games under our belt as we want. And, you know, we walked through all the keywords. You know, I was basically helping him kind of assign stats to his play table. and try to figure out, you know, the, whatever experience he was wanting to get.
Well, and that's what I like about in ninth edition. And I know that, you know, competitive play has largely agreed upon terrain according to the rule book. You know, so when you look at a forest, everybody can pretty much agree that the forest is has these terrain traits, right?
Yeah.
I admit when I first started looking at ninth edition, it came out, I understood that it was going to quickly evolve into that where people wanted to agree what generally the terrain was. But I kind of looked at some of the things and I thought that there was a lot of opportunity to increase some of that. Because sure, while a tank is not going to get a cover save, or, you know, a rhino or Impulsor or whatever is not going to get a cover save, it kind of makes sense if you put it behind ruins or whatnot, that wouldn't it kind of be dense to a certain extent? It's moving, you know, we're all kind of supposed to be somewhat moving simultaneously, moving through a building or through ruins or whatever. Like, so you see a true line of sight, you see a through the smallest, you know, let's say through ruins and through two or three windows or something, you can see the front of a tank. And that means that you're good to go.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean,
there's space there if it becomes a thing. I think it's sure. going to be module, but it's just kind of funny to hear different perceptions as more games get played, as people come and are finally getting their armies off the shelf, as we're able to kind of, you know, where it's safe to commune with each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. You know, so, like, I'm sorry I missed the conversation last week. I was having my own fun with my own wargaming sessions doing my real job, but the terrain discussion is awesome. Can I, Adam, you want to hear what my dream terrain is?
Hit me.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Dude, so I want rolling. I want, like, hills, because as hard as it is to believe, and I know I've said this before, imagine the fact that a tank could be, you know, 30 meters away from you and you can't see it somehow.
Mm.
Because that's just how the terrain is.
Because it's just a hill. Yeah, that's cool.
So trust me, I totally understand. Like, we're playing on a flat board and you set this stuff down. And we all know there's those annoying hills that people bring that your models can never sit on. They can never rest on. I totally get it. Trust me. There's got to be some kind of technological advancement that we can come up with that can do this. And I also understand that by doing this, the board's got to be, you know, it's going to be like 2 feet tall altogether to do this. And it's really hard to do over even like a 6x4 distance. Because to get that, but at the same time, like, that's real life, man. And I know, like, I'm just trying to get, we're hitting on the abstractions and so on. But like, the fact that a tank can be 30 meters away from you and you can't see it because it's just on the other side of an IV line should blow people's mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It would change so much about the game. I love it. I love that idea. I get the impracticalities. Like,
I know.
How do you construct such a thing? How do you transport such a thing?
You don't. It just sits in your basement. Trust me.
Hey, that becomes your place. I want a jungle terrain. Like, this is the Catechin homeworld.
Yeah, that would be tight. Yeah.
I found a cool tutorial on, well, it wasn't about how to make vines. It was actually about how to make Thor's Stormbreaker.
Mm.
And they made the handle out of this cool trick with ropes. And I'm like, holy crap, that could be vines. What a display in terrain, but for another day. Let me talk a little bit about this, some hobby stuff, if you don't mind, and then we could maybe take a break and then come back and talk about the AdMech weapons. I mean, this is it's a pretty big preview inside of a small article with the weapons.
Yeah,
it's probably worth talking about.
It changes a lot of things.
So in the hobby segment, I'm sitting right next to 20 built Blightlord Terminators.
Yuck.
They are glorious to behold. So it's a five-man kit, and some of the comments I got when I posted that I was going to be building them over the weekend was, you know, how are you going to make them look distinctive? Because there's, like, the poses are, like, the bodies, there's only 5 different bodies. But I do think there's a fair amount of variation in the way that you complete the poses that gives you a little bit of, I guess, customization in there. I went one step fancier and magnetized the heavy weapon arms.
Yep.
And because you get enough parts to make all the complete parts, like including shoulder pads and stuff. You've got enough to spread around. You're not going to run out of things. And I glued in the magnet on the body, but didn't have to glue in the magnet on the weapon. It just, like, with the drill bit that I used, which I actually used, still in red, in the pre-show, I used an 18-volt power drill. And It worked like a charm. Now, look, this is not an endorsement. Do not get out your power tools. Because what was your first question?
I mean, how many models did you break? Because I'm pretty sure I have a fair number of them.
Yes.
But the I think how I got away with it in this case is because you know how big and bulky a Blight Lord Terminator is? There's a lot of plastic there. And I made a little bit of a... like an indent for the drill bit to sit or to set, and then just used a little bit of careful pressure and sunk a hole in it and worked like a charm. I mean, really, I've seen people use like hobby drills before, but I didn't have one of those. So I had to get a little dangerous.
Yeah, but actually, I admire your courage because I would not have done that in a million years.
Well, I did it on the first one, you know, real carefully, and then it worked. I'm like, oh, crap. But this is the first time that it's actually the arm, the magnet on the arm that I didn't have to glue it in. It just, it was a, now I was using, I wish I could tell you what size magnet I was using. I don't know. I pulled it out of my, what has now become just a lump of a bunch of little magnets that have all stuck together, accumulated over the years. I just happened to have one, and it's probably twice as deep as maybe what a normal magnet I'd use for a space marine. And I'm not even going to begin to assume the size here, but there was it was pretty wide or pretty thick. And it was after I got the hole in there, it actually just kind of pressure fit in there and never came back out. So I was like, well, I guess I'm not going to put any super glue in there, which is the most annoying thing with magnets is getting super glue all over your hand. So I got to,
it's inevitable.
Yeah. I didn't do it this time because these chunky models basically allowed me to get a little bit, I guess, I don't want to say cavalier, but yeah, it worked out.
They're just resilient, man. They're built strong.
They are disgustingly resilient. That's it.
Ten years from now, when the next generation of Blight Lord Terminators come out, they'll be like, back in my day, you could just slot the magnet right into the armhole. And yeah. Some young kid will look at you like you're a daft old man, and they'll be right.
Yeah, please do. No one try this at home. Like, this is not. Do not try this at home.
But do the power drill at home.
Yeah, it worked over here. Yeah.
Forge narratives are not endorsed with the opinions of Paul Murphy and use the power drills and et cetera, et cetera.
Certainly not without a parent's permission. Do not try this at home. But it was. Yeah. I was just kind of happy the way it worked out. And so I wanted to share. It was like, I've seen people use like, you know, tiny like hobby drills before. And yep. I don't know, y'all magnetize things? I don't typically magnetize. Like the whole like magnet process, I might as well just build and paint another model.
What about you, Adam? You magnetize?
I do and I don't. It depends the purpose of which I'm building the model. I've started magnetizing a lot of special weapons. Like I'll never magnetize a bolter or anything of that nature. But with the shifting metrics of the game at the moment, especially when I started magnetizing more than ever before in 9th edition. Firstly, I was in lockdown for about a year and had better to do, you know, rather than buying 3 million models and, you know, building and painting them all. I was like, oh, yep, you have 9 models here. Just spend an hour longer or 2 hours longer on them than you were going to, and you got nothing better to do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I am magnetizing more now. But it's also in light of the changing, like I said, the changing metrics of 9th edition. I've got some friends of mine who we sat down, we broke down some things. 8th edition was a very plasma gun, thunder hammer edition. Like those were the two profiles that were just good on every army. If you could take those kinds of profiles, something similar, that was always going to be good. Now it's melt guns and lightning claws, essentially. And so in knowledge of that and knowledge that those things, these metrics kind of change with the ebb and flow of the rule set, I think magnetizing your special weapons is a good idea.
Yeah. Get a little extra life out of your miniatures and your time.
So,
too.
You know, yeah, exactly. So, you know, you got like 10 TAC Marines, you know, magnetize two of them out of 10. So you can have a different special weapon and a different heavy weapon, you know, that's all it is. That's all it is to give that thing, you know, possibly another edition's worth of viability. And that feels good.
Yeah. With, in this case, you know, I'm a big fan of the Blight launchers, but you know, I could see a reality where the plague spitters.
Yeah, for sure, man. Absolutely. All it would take is for you know, flamers to get blast, and you're like, "Hey, here we go, it's time."
Click, click. That's all you'd hear is all the magnets getting switched out.
Absolutely.
I did commit to the plague flails though, because those are, they look cool.
They do look awesome.
And I can't imagine ever not wanting to throw them.
What's the big mace that they've got? What's it called? Is it just a plague mace? I don't know.
The Blight Lords just have the flail.
It's the Plague Marines that have the big macey chunky. Yeah. That thing's cool.
Yeah. They look great. I cannot wait to paint them. They're not painted yet. They're just built, but even just built, they look pretty impressive.
Mm. Yeah, man. The models are amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I think they're, and look, they went together like a dream. I mean, I know I was just talking about the magnets, but with the way that the kit is designed, it didn't take very long to build that. I mean, I was kind of surprised I got through them as fast as I did.
Yeah, me too. Dude, you've been pretty prolific lately. Like, you just finished, would you say, 20 assault marines?
And I got over the hump. Yeah, it was 15 assault intercessors.
Oh, that's sorry, yeah.
And that, so that took me a while to get through. And by the way, I put them on the table, and they all died. So. But as true to fashion, the last miniature you painted is going to get removed first.
Should you have just painted them as Death Company assault intercessors? They're just all going to go get themselves killed.
I should have just put blade guards in the intercessors or the impulsors, scooted around instead of you running up to feel like a maniac.
What do you take on your impulses? Do you take the Invuln or do you take a bit of DACA, extra DACA? Or
no, that's another kit that you don't have to commit to. Like you don't even have to glue the weapons in. They basically just fit on there by themselves. But I appreciate the extra shots.
Yeah, I do as well. I think for 10 points, just giving them, is it 6 extra shots or 8 extra shots from the twin, is it the twin iron hail stubber? I just think that's fine. That's fine value right there.
Yeah, it really is, because it's basically free to get that on there. But, you know, to jump ahead to the next segment, so the reason that I shy away from the invulnerable save is the fact that by the time somebody hits, by the time you get your armor save from the last cannon, because you're saving on a 6 or whatever, and by the time they roll their mediocre damage, then you're basically going to live. So why even bother? Like, by the two turns that you live from being shot, you know, why even bother spending the points on the invulnerable save when you could just be removing somebody's models?
You haven't encountered the Dark Lance yet, have you?
Well, that's it. But see, that's what I'm saying. So now, with the change to the it's not a more reliable potency of some of these things, then maybe that makes a strong case for the invulnerable save.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, no, look. I mean, you take almost all of my heavy Necron guns that are all D6 except for one, which is on the heavy destroyer for the most part. And sure, I totally agree. Like relatively mediocre damage, but you start adding in these weapons like we're going to discuss with the AdMech and then take into account the Dark Lance at 3+D3.
And you at this point you have to assume this is the new profile for this kind of weapon.
Like the traditional top end heavy weapon is going to be consistent damage.
Yeah, exactly right. Like I don't want to make entire speculation or assumptions here, but I could very well see demolisher cannons going this way, which I think is already terrifying and very exciting for me personally. I'm probably red. But yeah, if you have a keystone weapon, I also expect the Onaga Doomcrawler. One of their weapons should get this treatment, surely.
Well, that's already a bruiser, isn't it?
Yeah, it's min 3. It's a D6 min 3. So essentially, it would just essentially be almost +1 damage to that one. But yeah, that one's hampered by only having, I think, something has D3 shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, low volume.
So you should want to have ultra high quality. But it's AdMech. They don't seem to be lacking in quality all of a sudden.
Well, I thought their weapons have always been pretty good, you know. But it's interesting to see that there's a push to. And then we'll talk about the change of difference. But I understand that. We play a game with space lasers and aliens, and we've talked about inanimate objects on the tabletop for several episodes, but terrain is just such a key factor in the enjoyment of the game, and I think it's worth talking about. Heck, I got a couple of questions in chat today about people wanting to flesh out their table and what should they get. And I still think line of sight blocking is king. But you can also, once you've established your two like central line of sight blocking things and maybe a couple of like line of sight blocking things for the corners, you can, I think, kind of get creative with the rest of your table.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll go off on a little bit and then I'll let, you know, Adam, if you'd like to tap in a second, because your competitive capacity could probably better explain some of the gaming stuff to it. But for me, I mean, you think that at least in my opinion, Paul, for a line of sight being such a big deal is because it forces you to do stuff. All right. Like now because that's what maneuver is. There's in the words themselves, there's actually a very clear and discrete difference between movement and maneuver. you don't move to shoot, you maneuver to shoot. It is maneuvering is putting yourself in a position of advantage in order to engage. And when you have line of sight blocking terrain, you sometimes you start with, you know, not in a good position or whatnot, but it makes you move and it makes you get into the fight. And that's why it seems like such a good concept to it. And that's the next part. When we go into a battlefield or something like that, there's two major things that everyone assesses, not counting just yourself as well, right? You come to the battle, you should come to the battle knowing yourself to a certain extent. But the two things that you look at are the terrain and the enemy. Those are the two core things that you're sitting there that you have to assess before you begin your planning and your action. And that's where you want the terrain to be dynamic enough that it makes you have to think and move through it, right? And if it's not, there are some advantages. There should be things such as dead space, those danger zones, those engagement areas, kill zones, whatever you want to call it. Those exist, and those are tactical problems. But it makes a game dynamic if you have to figure out whatever the puzzle is to get around it, just so you can even play with the other person. Like there's a whole balance to that I think tournaments, I won't say that they struggle with it, I'd say that tournaments are always striving to present a better sample of terrain for the players when they go through it.
From my point of view, I think what Red said is obviously, you know, truthfully and correctly. This is a man who has a profession and a stake in knowing things of this stripe. But like you said, when you rock up to a battlefield, you assess your enemy and you assess your terrain. Only one of those two can you generally control prior to the battle. If you're already in a battle, you know, already in a battlefield, you've essentially committed to an enemy. And so therefore, the only place you can really pick is how you interact with the battlefield and how you decide or dictate where the battle takes place. Now, we can't really do that because, you know, you get assigned a freaking table, you know, at the tournament or whatnot, and you just rock up and you get what you get. But that doesn't mean you need to fight your combats in the middle of the open terrain. That doesn't mean you need to let your mainline battle tanks sit behind obscuring terrain and never get to shoot, et cetera, et cetera. So what I want from terrain is I want there to be an intuitive way to interact with it that's cognitive of how we want our immersive experience to be. Does that make sense? I think I've used Absolutely. A lot of big words there, but that's I think the point is pretty clear. And I think we've got a good rule set for doing that. I feel like it's better than it's ever been for that. My favorite terrain piece is the forest because I hate seeing it.
Oh, because of minus one? Traditionally, the minus one applied to it?
The minus one hurts, to my mind, hurts guard and tower more than everybody else. Taking us from force to five is the biggest pain in efficiency that we have in a game. But I love to see it on the table because it is a factor. You're always going to have kind of ruins. There's always going to be some form of obscuring prevalent. But the number of forests and those, the sometimes craters, those terrain pieces, is the one that I seem to be in flux from event to event, table to table, battlefield to battlefield. And so that's the one that kind of dictates how I want to play and how I want to wield my assets.
Well, I mean, that's one of the comments we got from the last show was that people's like, you know, some of us rely on dense cover to, you know, make our armies function, you know, so we don't get just wiped out by some of these other armies, which is an incredibly fair point.
Sure. Well, and then consider, so, I mean, you're spot on, Adam, in regards of you should be able to choose the terrain to a certain extent, right? And really the way that we kind of in most scenarios demonstrate that is through deployment. Right. Like how you deploy is how you moved into the environment. No, you don't always get to necessarily choose your deployment zones, but you do get to you do have some say in that. Right. And that's where I understand there are pushes for everybody having the same kind of table to certain degrees, you know, because when you go into a competitive environment, when you're reducing the degrees of variance, I can understand the argument for that when you want to have like every table has the same kind of terrain. However, I'd argue that. You know, we're playing this war game with these, we're trying to reach these, there's a balance, there's this threshold of reality that we're trying to reach in regards of how we can play this, you know, with tactics and whatnot. And at the same time, there's that other side of that balance is accepting the abstractions in front of us.
Yeah.
But the next part being, so think of, I mean, Adam, have you been to Adepticon?
I have not, unfortunately, had the pleasure.
But Paul, you definitely have, right?
Oh yeah.
And they do player placed terrain there, right?
It goes back and forth, but yeah.
Sure. I'm not condoning that this is the best or the ultimate way, but you want to talk about having the choice of like how the terrain and the battlefield that you wanted to fight. There are some other elements time to be considered, but I think player placed terrain has an aspect to it that could be appreciated in regards of going into a fight with terrain and whatnot.
Man, I don't know. I go back and forth with how I feel about player placed terrain, but I'm generally prefer it if it's TO placed terrain.
Sure.
Or fixed terrain.
I mean, yeah, because it does add it adds a whole other element, right? And I can totally understand. I'll tell you what I did sort of like from the last LVO that we were able to attend. I think maybe it was only the so many tables up, but they had essentially the terrain shifted according to these different diagrams they had. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. I was totally on board with
that. I thought that was very, very clever. I mean, TOs have enough work to be doing already without them giving themselves more. But at the same time, I really respected the hustle. I said, hey, here's our top 100 tables out of 500, and we're going to move all the terrain on these every single game. I respected that quite a lot. Interesting. I don't know how you'd feel about a real life question now, Red, as in a real life application warfare battlefield question. I know from historical readings and being a big history nerd, especially around the Napoleonic era, standardly, unless it was like a really drawn battlefield, there'd always be a posture to each force. Mm-hmm. Being a raid being deployed, like, you know, you'd be deployed into an offensive or defensive posture or stance, so to speak. Is that still something that's in like modern warfare, modern battlefields?
Absolutely. So the space has expanded drastically due to technology, right?
Incredibly. Like, instead of just being literally Brian's paddock, right. We're going to line up in Brian's paddock next week, be there, be square. It's like, you know, a city, a whole cityscape, right?
Sure. Oh, I mean, again, the distances at which someone can proverbially reach out and touch you are drastically, you know, it is exponentially higher. And so when you consider that, how you're arrayed or your formations, there's absolutely formations. I kind of like the idea of some of these formations. You know, they brought this stuff in from Apocalypse in the last couple editions of these formations. Like, you know, if you've got three predators, they had the kill shot ability, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because when I take like tanks, right? And there's actually an equation that you can do that has, you're using the determining the hypotenuse or whatever, essentially of the breadth of the battlefield to yourself. But so when you take a formation and you put yourself out, right? And there's degrees of dispersion, because think about it, right? And the scope of it, if I've got a tank that can reach out and destroy something at 2 kilometers, if you're within 200, 300 meters of each other, like, all that is just a 2 second turn to the left to hit the next target, right? And so you want to spread yourself out. You have to have the ability and means to communicate. And so for vehicle, for mounted warfare, mechanized warfare, you have to disperse, because the closer you are, the more easily you're acquired as a target. And so there's all of this about how you're set up and whatnot. And that's what's cool about coherency. You know, we moved away from, in Warhammer 40K, we moved away from set movement values, right? We moved away from everybody moving 6 inches to suddenly now, like, everybody has their own distinct movement values. And what's,
not,
you know,
suddenly now, that was, we were locked into 6 and 12 or whatever. Was it 2 editions?
Sure.
Yeah. All the 6th and 7th. Yeah.
Yeah. I think 5th was the same thing. I don't think they had separate movement, or maybe they did, but but there were other times before that where we had different movement values, right? And so you're right. It's not like a suddenly.
I guess when you started playing, it might determine whether or not you feel like it's suddenly or not. Like, I was
true. That's very true. But so with this, though, imagine if units had different, and I understand, you know, again, simplicity, gameplay, whatnot, but couldn't Space Marines in the elite units that they are maybe have 4-inch coherency?
Well, that's a thing in Horus Heresy. Custodians actually have 6-inch coherency, I think would be an awesome thing for them to add into 40K.
Sure, right. And so, like, that kind of dispersion, and we're sitting here talking about terrain, like how you could spread out a unit across a distance because they have the ability to communicate to each other just that much better. And that's that. I mean, that's we have the technology, we can build it. It's just a matter of understanding that what levels of complexity does that add to the war game that we're sitting here playing?
Yeah. Yeah. Great way of saying it.
I like that. Well, speaking of, you know, but like deployment and that kind of stuff, when I'm looking at either the deployment zone I've chosen or the one that has been assigned to me because of the opponent's choice, I'm typically thinking about like where can I place my stuff to that saves me time in the early rounds of the game. Like if I'm planning to go somewhere or I want to be somewhere to fire or whatever, it's, I mean, am I maneuvering even when I'm deploying?
You absolutely are, because you got to think about it. You're essentially, your deployment is really your first move, right? Mm. You didn't just like magically show up. You're technically, you've moved onto the field. That is your maneuver. The point of maneuver is when you are essentially within range of contact, right? You can be, and contact does not have to be direct fire. Contact is observation. It is indirect. It is, I mean, there's electronic, the U.S. military has 8 forms of contact that we view as. And so once you find yourself in that, you're maneuvering because you're being detected, you're being collected on, you're being assessed, you've got to figure out. And so when you go into deployment, right, they can technically see you. You're under observation, mm-hmm. and so you are absolutely maneuvering when you go into deployment.
Yeah, that's what you that's how you choose to array yourself for battle. Like that's how you move onto the battlefield in order for the engagement, right?
Right, and so that's where, you know, sometimes people will say in some games they won or lost in deployment to certain mm-hmm. extents, yeah. right? And that's where, you know, Adam, you mentioned like Napoleon, right? So Napoleon, a lot of the verbiage that I've used has developed over time through military history and theory, but Napoleon was in a time of positional advantage, right?
Huge,
massive, right? And the people that he was fighting was, you know, we look at it now, they were under the assumption that if they got into a position of advantage, you essentially would quit the field because you weren't even going to go in and fight it. And however, Napoleon, who brought corps to fight and to bear upon the multiple coalitions he fought, he was willing to go the distance and close with and fight the enemy to the point that they would lose their force and no longer be able to fight until, you know, sometime later, in which of course they all came back. But he would get in a position of advantage and then he just wouldn't let him go. And so that pursuit was such a huge thing, to pursue the enemy and essentially annihilate them on the battlefield. And that's where a lot of us, when we go into it, you can't quit the field. You know, you can't just be like, oh, well, they got the position of advantage, let's just pack it up. I mean, you're going to sit there and fight for it. And that's what's cool about 9th edition and the objectives based and a lot of the other concepts that they've added in, because the balance to it, you're going to go in there and you might not have initially the positional advantage. And understanding this is a tactical framework, you know, there's no follow-on operation to it. It's not like, you know, you've got to go the next distance. It's, in this case, it's just a series of these small tactical, isolated tactical events. And so it's just so crazy and cool. And so much that I love about this game has just played out in this last bit of conversation.
Heck yeah. Well, actually, let's take a break. Then we'll come back and slow it down and talk about Cognos weapons and stuff.
Yeah. AdMech. Woo!
We'll see you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. I still got Adam and Red here.
Oh hey.
Hello.
Update to the AdMech weapons that we've seen, you know, coming soon. And, you know, some changes here. Things going from like rapid fire to heavy. Like,
yeah,
and getting a better AP, but I think the biggest change is the going to heavy two on the galvanic rifle.
Yeah, it's an interesting one that it's heavy two. I found that to be of all the ones that they showed us or they teased, that one was the one that I had my head scratching. All the other ones just seemed intuitive. They seemed to make sense to me. So a galvanic rifle used to be range 30, rapid fire 1, strength 4. No minus 1 damage. A six to wound is 1 AP, yeah? Mm-hmm. And now it's just heavy 2, so always 2 shots at 30 inches, with strength 4, always rend 1 damage. So it's arguably better, right? Because it's 2 shots at 30 inches, but you might have had to have moved and hit on 4s.
Well, yeah, you don't want these folks too close to people anyway. And I, you have to imagine that there's going to be buffs to auras to buff to hit. So maybe this is like, we don't even know how good this is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, with, yeah, without context, it just, to me, it looks like a straight buff, but it looks like an interesting one. It looks like an interesting one. Like, the, it actually is, there's some decent risk rewards here.
And as far as like exchanging the movement for always one AP on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Always a little better hit. Because this is essentially a better version of the Intercessor gun, which was rapid fire one at 30 inches or 24, whichever. I can't remember. For some reason, I think that the basic Intercessor gun, the bolt rifle, is 30 inch range, but I'm probably wrong. It's probably just 24. But it seems like a better version of that, because this one's got 6 inches more range to my size. Always two shots, doesn't need to be rapid fire range, or a Space Marine has to stand still to trigger bolter discipline, which is the same as these guys. These guys would have to not move in order to hit twice on threes, the same as an Intercessor, at the same profile, strength 4-1. This guy is probably on a significantly cheaper chassis model.
Yeah, I don't know what they are right now. What are they currently? We can check.
We probably should have been prepared for that question. But yeah, I'm a fan of this change. I like this bit.
Hang on, I'm gonna get us a start. Yeah, Skitarii Rangers are 9 points apiece currently.
Yeah, correct. So literally half the points of an Intercessor.
Yeah, for the same gun or exactly, incredibly similar gun, which you're going to be shooting with them in the early round of the game too, I think, right?
Yeah, I actually the more I think about it, the more I actually love this change. I think it's really good and adds something flavorful to them also.
Yeah, squad 10, Rangers, 90 Rangers points.
Always, yeah, Rangers always just seemed like, what do they do? Why are they here? You know, were you taking the expensive transonic aquabus, or were they just like, oh, here's my five guys you'll never see because they're just going to sit on this objective and take no part? Now they feel like they have a meaningful contribution to make.
No, I think the aquabus is real. It's why you would take them. I mean, the thing has a 60-inch range.
Sniper.
No lookout, sir, capability.
I feel like I'm missing something. We're talking about, this is the same Rusty 17.
Yep.
You're saying you don't, those guys have been sitting on objectives since throughout all of 8th edition, while everything else and whatever army it was just, you know, went hog wild. While, yeah, exactly. Two, what can they do? One or two of those sniper rifles? Two of them, right?
I think it's one per five, or is it two?
I thought it was two per five. I might be crazy though.
Either way, I just remember those dudes just sitting back, not barely touched, sniping me, just holding objectives as the rest of their army was really the bigger issue. I gave them plenty of credit for at least, in comparison to some of my other units that just have to sit back and not really be able to reach out as far as those things were.
So it's it says that up to two Skitarii Rangers may replace their Galvanic Rifle with one item from the special weapons list.
There you go.
Nice.
So I think that, yeah, I think that counts as a special weapon. I think it's 10 points, so it's you're basically doubling the cost of the squad if you keep it like that. But I think it's a very powerful weapon, and that's why you take these guys now. But now I think the rest of the squad get to play as well now.
Sure. 30 inches, yeah.
It's interesting that a lot of the smaller gun profiles, like the special weapons for things like the Vanguards, things like the Rangers, they didn't, apart from the Aquabus on the Rangers, like I didn't see Vanguard with any special weapons. Like, usually they're just packing their bare guns. And the vast majority of the time, I saw Rangers with no weapons on them either. And it's interesting what they've done with the ARC weapons. Like, ARC weapons have always been like the non-Haywire. Like, you think of Haywire, you think, like, here's the anti-mechanized. And the ARC rifle is also the anti-mechanized, but different. If that makes sense. Yep. But now they've given it a personality. Now you've got some characteristics and traits attached to that ARC brand, so to speak.
So the ARC rifle, the old is 24-inch, rapid fire 1, strength 6, neg 1 AP, damage 1. When attacking a vehicle, this weapon has a damage characteristic of D3. And then the ARC rifle, the new, is each time an attack is made with this weapon against a vehicle unit, that attack has a damage characteristic of 3 and an unmodified wound roll of 4+ successfully wounds the target. And it's strength 6, neg 2 AP, D3 normally.
Yeah, it got another 6-inch on its range. It's now 30-inch rapid fire.
Oh, yeah.
It went from strength 6, rend 1, 1 damage, 24 inches, to range 30 inches, an extra rend. And essentially, like an extra 2 damage, possibly, automatically, it was an extra 2 damage against vehicles, and always wounds them on a 4, like poison 4+ against vehicles. Really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, the Galvanic Rifle, ARC Rifle, is currently 5 points.
If there's still 5 points, that's good.
Well, I mean, we've seen, Red, what was the change from a Dark Lance, points-wise?
It was strength 8, AP minus 4, D6 damage. Now it is strength 8, AP minus 4, 3 plus D3 damage.
But point-wise, is basically the same?
Depends. So if it's going on infantry, it becomes 10 points. on most vehicles, it's actually either built in or it's a 5-point, I think. And so, like, that's not bad in a lot of cases.
Not bad at all.
No, yeah. And I think if given that, I wouldn't be surprised if arc rifles hung in there at 5 points.
It's a very good weapon at 5 points. It's been like
awesome. It's awesome.
Lots of things are vehicles that you might not suspect. I mean, like dreadnoughts, which we see people taking and stuff. And that's one of the things that people have been doing with dreadnoughts, is kind of like planting them in the backfield and having them do dreadnoughty things.
Well,
yeah, exactly.
And the, taking it that it goes to 3 damage, you know, if it was 2 damage, so much of 2 damage gets worn down by, you know, like dreadnoughts -1 to damage, or disgustingly resilient, or what have you. But 3 damage is enough to lock it in. Right, because it's just, I'd definitely take 2 damage, have it after the modifier still be 2 damage. That's massive. 3 damage is great.
I love there's no Titanic restrictions here, so it's a nice night you got there. I'm gonna win tonight at 4. Flat 3 damage.
That is crazy.
It's really good. This next one is the one I was happiest to see. It's pretty much just telling us about the increase for AP for the razors. The Sakaar and Rustalkers melee weapons.
Yep.
I've long thought the Rustalkers and the Infiltrators were my favorite models in the AdMech range, and they have been, apart from like one little glimpse that I thought they got in 7th edition, they have been completely unheralded for all of 8th and all of 9th so far. Apart from like taking one unit of Infiltrators to just make sure you get scrambles and some engage points, they just don't have a legitimate function. And in a lot of ways, I thought it was an interesting play by G-Dub that they brought in the Taraxi that just felt like better versions of the Rustalkers and Infiltrators. Does anybody else feel that way?
Which ones are those?
The Bird Boys.
The Boys, yeah.
The Flappy.
Yeah.
I just felt like they were just a better version of the Rustalkers, right? You're like, could I take the Rustalkers who don't fly, move less, hit worse? Or I take the Taraxi who do all these things better? And it's like, well, you know, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, no, I think the addition of the flying versions was a huge, like, kind of an obvious shift. I will tell you, if you've played the AdMech game, like the computer game, Rustalkers are, I like them so much in that game, I'd almost be inspired if I had an AdMech army to make sure I incorporated some of those. Because
yeah, well, I've got 15 beautifully painted ones that I painted for a 7th edition formation, the Sakaar and Killclade, and it was one of the funnest things I ever used in 7th edition, even when like the heyday of formations when they weren't feel so good. They were just so much fun that I kept playing with them. But now, so what's changed here is their transonic blades are now AP3 and the transonic razors are AP2. So you can put them with the blades or the razors. I'm assuming there's going to be maybe the blades will get +1 strength as well or whatnot. But there'll be like a trade-off in points, of course, to get those things done. But man, AP2 base, AP3 base, that's kind of the perfect sweet spot for what they want to be doing, right? Explosive melee pushes and applying pressure, because they are still a fragile unit. They're usually they're toughness 3. They go in and just explode, but be happy to explode after you've done some AP3 goodness.
Well, the transonic blades, I mean, they're like currently like no AP, right?
Yes.
So this is a massive, I mean, if you had them before, you're going to love them now.
That's right. Crack them out. See how they go.
But then it goes into the Cognis stuff. And so the old Cognis weapons, there's 3 profiles. What's the big changes here?
So firstly, of course, the Cognis, the Flamer, of course, it's got its 12-inch range now. So usually the Cognis weapon, what it used to do was you could advance and fire it, even though it wasn't an assault weapon, or you got to overwatch it with it better, which you could do with some stratagems and some other things and pieces. Now, the old Cognis Flamer was range 8, assault D6, strength 4, blah, 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 automatically hits, and it went firing overwatch, you roll 2 dice and discard at the lowest. And now that Cognis Flamer is, range 12, it's assault D6 plus 2, so it starts off a -3 shots on the Flamer, and of course it just auto hits now. It doesn't do the special stuff with the Overwatch, but you start off with 3 hits. I like this much better. I'd love to see this adopted to more Flamers as well.
I feel like that's statistically better than rolling 2.
Yeah, well,
I mean, well, when you get 8.
Well, you get that buff all the time, which is what's cool. It doesn't just happen in Overwatch, which is the condition that the other one had. Breaking that down further, the heavy stubber, you could, the old one was in heavy 3, strength 4, of course, just a boltish profile. You may fire this weapon even if the firing model has advanced, but you subtract 2 from if you do so. That wasn't a thing, because we know that the modifiers to pluses and to hits are capped at 1 each way. So -2 meant literally nothing. Now that same one is the same 36-inch range, but it's assault 4 of the bolter profile. So it's just straight 4 shots for all that goodness. And then last one, the Twig Cognis autocannon. It used to be heavy 4 at 48-inch range, and you the same minus 2 if you advanced. Now it's just 6 shots instead of 4 shots. Same autocannon profile. So it's just they're just pretty much across the board. Just if it's Cognis, it just gets more shots.
Yeah, with assault. You know, so all the things that will come from that.
Yeah, exactly right.
And then the old Twin Cognis Las Cannon. Now these are on the Walkers, if I recall correctly.
Correct. They are on the Ballistari, right?
Yep. And the old one was strength heavy 2, strength 9, neg 3 AP, D6 damage. Twin Cognis Las Cannon now are what will be assault 2, strength 9, neg 3, D3 plus 3 damage.
Mm. Yeah, yikes. I like this very, very much.
It seems like it's going to hit pretty hard.
I've played a bunch of games in the Dark Elder now, and the guys I'm playing are usually having, you know, somewhere in the region of 6 to 7 Dark Lance Raiders. So these things are essentially the same thing with better strength. One better strength, one less rend. It's essentially the same. And man, they slay. They just slay. They're so strong.
Yeah, so then the torsion cannon that the Cataphon Breachers can carry in place of their heavy arc rifles has had a similar upgrade, now doing D3 plus 3 damage, and its range is doubled to a mighty 48 inches.
Yeah, like before them telling me that change, I couldn't have told you what a torsion cannon did. Red, did you actually even know what they did? I have no idea. never heard of one.
This is on a troop, you know that?
Yeah, yep.
This is a troop.
Mm-hmm.
Man.
They are fearsome. They are absolutely fearsome. Their troop choices all of a sudden feel a lot better. Yeah, buff to a nice relevant buff to ranges weapons.
Yeah.
We're going to see some buff to some of the more obscure breacher weapons. Now here's one that I love as well. Destroyers. Destroyers were kind of unheralded as well. Like if you wanted to take destroyers, you just take Castellans. You just pad out some special weapons on your stuff, or you just take a knight. Right? You want what they do? Chuck a Castellan in your list. You're gonna just do it better, and they're gonna survive longer. This is the big issue with destroyers. You want to just take these plasma culverins on them that are like D6 shots, amazing plasma. When you took them as riser, you got +1 damage, +1 wound. It was amazing. But every one to hit was like a whole dead breacher. These things are real expensive.
Yeah.
But now, when they supercharge their plasma culverins, they take one mortal wound on ones rather than just losing a whole model. That is so much better. That's so much better.
So these things currently are 43 points a model before you spend any points on maybe upgrading a weapon.
Yeah.
So you don't want them. You don't want to be rolling ones and removing whole models.
Exactly right, man.
So this is a huge buff across the board. One, it brings them in line. I mean, their stats all make sense, you know, for this edition. And this is a potent upgrade to these weapons, so they should be deadly.
Absolutely, this is the ad mech, man. They're here to they're here to pull you apart and not feel anything about doing it.
Oh. No, I agree. Guns should be deadly. I agree.
Well, I mean, these things, you know, it's the particular way it does it. I think they should be lethal, and you know, it should be kind of glass cannon-ish, you know, unless you're on the robot frame, and you can play the army both ways. And right now, it's not looking to me like one side is better than the other.
No, they look awesome. I think it's great. I think the updates are awesome. I think that the GW's got a good head on like where they're going with it. I hope that they take that and go back and maybe update some of my Necron guns. I'm sorry. Let's continue with the ad mech.
Plenty right now. Well, that's it. That's all from the preview that the article that was up. It
looks good, man. I'd be very happy to see ad mech being more prevalent on the table. More people getting excited about them as well. They're a range that I don't think has gotten anywhere near as much love as I thought they would. I think the way that that GW introduced us to ad mech in 7th edition kind of put them in an awkward spot thereafter. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys at all.
It does. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah. So when I think about how the community got introduced to ad mech, it was pretty much like they got these two codexes, one being the two very slim codexes, and they were cut in half. They had the Sectari codex and they had the Adeptus Mechanicus codex. Now, what happened was the only way to weld those two together without taking, you know, two CADs back in the day was to use a formation that was called the, what was it called?
The War Convocation.
War Convocation, yeah. And what the War Convocation was if you had to take one of every Sectari unit and one of every Adeptus Mechanicus unit and a knight. And so it was just one of everything, chucked it all together, and they got a huge amount of buffs. All their upgrades were free, guys. And back then, it was a huge deal because the amount of upgrades you could chuck on even just a breacher, like upgrade the gun, upgrade the weapon, it was crazy. You just saved so many points. And that's how people got introduced to this, running out, buying one of everything. And from GW, that was very smart. They moved a lot of the whole range at once. But thereafter, when that formation went away and people looked at that collection, they were like, this isn't cohesive anymore. This doesn't work together. This doesn't make sense. And people just started realizing, hey, I'm going to have to actually triple this collection in order to make it kind of functional. And I think that's just been actually a big deterrent for people. It's kind of become a barrier to entry.
Little less easy to pick up in trades and stuff too, because you know even right. they have
yeah.
it. Yeah. So yeah, it's a little bit of a barrier. Like I guess very similar to Gene Stealer cults. You know, there's some of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly right. And you know, this is a modern, very well designed range. And
I love all the figures.
A price tag.
I do. I think
exactly right. I think
I love all. This is, you know, we talked a bit about things that are uniquely 40K, and this is like. Very uniquely 40K.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, to the point they incredibly, and with that, you know, looking at this last addition to the range, like think about it, Adam, I completely agree in regards to the war convocation. And then look at their second release, right? When the flying Skitarii, like you were talking about, when they were released, when the plane was released, you remember everybody reacting to them, to the plane, and it's like Leonardo da Vinci kind of aesthetic to it and everything. But remember when it released and when it started coming out, really, we're talking as COVID was really like the shutdown was really starting to settle in. And games weren't being played as much. Yeah. I think that's the second kind of phase that kind of hurt the AdMech release and why you don't see them as much is because all these models started coming out, but no one was playing at that time.
Yeah.
And so like it just you didn't really have there wasn't, you guys talked about the cut. Right. Yeah. You didn't have events that were driving people to get this stuff to play it. I mean, TTS a little bit, but really events weren't happening. And so people weren't really like striving to get these models on the table. And yeah, I agree. It cut the hype. I think that's another contributing factor for sure.
Yeah, well, folks, listen, if you've made it this far, I invite you to like, share, subscribe, do all that stuff. I should have mentioned in the beginning of the show, but thanks.
Hit all the buttons.
Just do it. Just fire away.
Mash the keyboard with your face. Don't do that. And don't use the power tools either.
Five-star review. Yeah, no power tools, but five-star reviews, except for that. Well, gentlemen, thanks for joining me. Hopefully, Tanya will be back with us next week. And yeah, thanks, everybody, for listening.
Take care.
My absolute pleasure.
We'll see y'all.
Handle the truth.